Well, hello, this is Doc Mike here with the show Redneck Dentist on Real Liberty Media. Hope the sound is better this week than last. I don't know, we'll give it a few minutes or a minute or two and find out. Man, what a busy week it has been. I know last week I had to cut out the kind of the beginning of the show where I was talking about the kids in the cardboard boxes, and that, you know, I'm not going to go revisit it so much now, but it was just so dang funny, them wearing these small square boxes. And my point that I was trying to get at is it reminded me of Lost in Space and that robot that was on Lost in Space. Anyway, and that was last Saturday, right before the show last Saturday. But ever since then, man, there's been a lot of stuff going on here at the homestead that I wanted to share with you this week, because it's kind of, I think each one of these things are kind of important in their own way, and just, it's just kind of normal stuff. And I also wanted to say, just kind of as a disclaimer, I am by no means an expert in probably anything I talk about other than dentistry. That's the one thing I would claim I'm pretty damn good at. So, you know, and I'm always happy to share stories of my life in the dental world. And I will be sharing kind of an interesting story today also, and we'll get to that in just a couple minutes. But last week, so Saturday, we had kind of a birthday event here. That was a lot of fun. Had the grandkids up, had the daughter and son-in-law, and the son and daughter-in-law, and their kids, all of our grandkids, and that was pretty fun. And then, you know, so after everybody left, so after the show, we, you know, had some grilled food. It was delicious, of course, as always. And then Sunday morning, you know, so wife and I kind of had the evening to ourselves and woke up in the morning, kind of, you know, got our day started on Sunday. We always soak in the tub, in the hot tub. It's outside, kind of on the back deck. I built the deck around the hot tub. I built a space for a hot tub, and it's worked out just great. So we're sitting in the tub. Well, I get out of the tub first and come in the house, and I'm getting dried off and changed, and I hear my wife say coyote, and like she's at the complete opposite end of the house. And I mean, we live far enough, I mean, kind of at the edge of some forest, and, you know, we get wildlife here. Last year, somebody took a black bear, about 350-pound black bear, maybe 360, I can't remember, and he had been on a game camera just 15 yards off our property. So we're close enough to forest to have wildlife. And yeah, coyotes come through once in a while, and they have to be dealt with. So I hear my wife not yell coyote, but she wanted to alert me that there was a coyote nearby. So I heard her. And, you know, my hearing isn't the greatest. You listen to a dental drill for 40 years or whatever it's been, and, you know, you kind of lose some hearing. But I did kind of make out the word just enough to know that, you know, there was a predator nearby. So my favorite rifle is a New England Arms 223. And the reason it's my favorite is because it's, number one, a single shot, which means there's not a lot of moving parts on that weapon, and I have a really nice scope on it, and it is sighted in. And I, you know, people argue about different rounds for different things all the time, but I'm just telling you, that 223 round in a single shot rifle, at least my setup, I probably haven't shot that rifle in easily over a year, but I just know 100% it is dead on. So I asked her, I kind of went a little bit through the house, and I said, where is it? And she kind of told me where it was. So and then she says, you're gonna have to go out all the way around, you know, some fencing, and you know, before I could get a shot, and I was like, nope, I am not doing that. I didn't say it. I just went to this other side of the house right across from the studio here, the man cave, and I gently slid open the sliding glass door, and sure enough, I could see the little coyote's face right at the gate eyeballing my chickens. So, you know, I knew right away that what that coyote was after. And I mean, who could blame it? It's easy pickings. We've had them come through, even when we were outside in the yard before, come through and take a chicken and run off. So, you know, you got to kind of take care of those things. But anyway, my wife actually told me there were two coyotes. And I couldn't see the second one, but I had the first one, you know, dead to rights, just staring kind of straight across the field, which was kind of a little bit quartered, not really quartered away from me, I mean toward me, but a little bit. Problem was, there was a T-post right in front of that coyote's heart. So, you know, I was thinking, I could shoot it in the head, but I really hate that because it's pretty gruesome when you hit them in the head. And yeah, I know they're going to be dead one way or the other, but you know, in, I guess just for me, also because I was a trapper and did handle furs before, I guess that kind of doesn't make sense. I was going to say, well, I'd try and shoot them right in the heart, but actually, if you shoot them in the head, you get a really nice pelt because you don't have any damage to the pelt. But anyway, yeah, took that coyote out, and of course, the instant I pulled the trigger, the other coyote was gone, so there's no chance at getting a shot at him. But we kind of been looking for him for the last week, thinking that maybe he would come back, but haven't seen him yet. Another incident on the, I got to turn a couple things off here, sorry. All right. So another incident that happened on the homestead this week that kind of is going to tie back into the coyote story a little bit is we had one of the grandkids. I know I talked about this in a prior episode. He actually hatched one of the eggs as kind of a project for school, I guess. And anyway, unfortunately, the chick he hatched turned out to be a male. And I think I've said before how, you know, I even had to get rid of another adult rooster about a month ago. And I'm sure I talked about that on the Redneck Dennis show here on Real Liberty Media also. And those two roosters were together for like a year, year and a half. And then all of a sudden one day it was just like, okay, I've had enough of you. And, you know, the young rooster took out the old rooster. And in this case, the rooster was really young. And I'm not sure if it was that rooster that started pecking on this young rooster's head, but the hens all kind of jumped in on it, and it was battered pretty good. So I had to, euthanize that rooster too, which we knew we were going to have to. It's just a matter of time. And, you know, you really hate to do that because it was the kid's project. But, you know, it's a good lesson for children to learn that that's the way stuff happens. I mean, you have to take care of your animals one way or another. Sometimes you have to do what's best for them, and that is, you know, you have to kill them, you have to take care of them. And, you know, just like predator control, I don't mind predators around and about as long as they're not going to cause any problems or take any of my producing animals. But when you have predators around, they're kind of looking for a meal. Generally, I mean, they reproduce and they eat. That's kind of predators' jobs. So if you have easy pickings, they are going to help themselves. It's like the smorgasbord for them. So anyway, I killed the young rooster, and I actually put it where those coyotes were coming up to the property, hoping that I would catch that other coyote. And I know, I can't say I know, I'm about 90% sure that that second coyote was a male, because the one I shot was a female, and she was a young female, didn't look like she'd had pups before, so probably what, a yearling, maybe 2 years old. I don't know how old they are when they start having pups, but being that the other coyote was much bigger than her, I'm assuming it was a mature male. And anyway, so we offed that other rooster and kind of tried to coax that other coyote into coming up so we could take care of him too. But he hasn't been around. At least we haven't seen him. He might have come and taken that chicken, because I haven't seen that chicken either, the carcass of the chicken, I should say. And, you know, they're pretty efficient at gathering up food, so they probably did come. He probably did come and get that chicken and go off. So anyway, that kind of stuff was happening on the homestead this week. And then the other thing is, I was talking in chat earlier about taking care of gophers. Now, I'll just tell you, my wife absolutely hates gophers. Like, they drive her insane. When she sees dirt flying, she's on that 22, you know, getting ready to take care of gophers. Now, I would say that a 22 is a pretty efficient way of taking care of gophers, but here's the problem. Like, unless you actually see that gopher throwing dirt and coming out of the hole, you're going to be sitting a long time waiting to shoot a gopher. Because they only come out different, you know, times a day. Sometimes you see them in the morning. I mean, I've seen them at all times of the day or night. So, and I wouldn't say they are predictable, like you could sit out in the morning and wait for them to come out. But my point is, yeah, 22 is a good way to do it, but it's going to take you a while. Like, you know, you have to keep checking to see if they're digging, see if they're opening up their gopher hole. And then, you know, and then you have to keep your rifle trained on that spot and hope that they come up, because they don't just come up and stand around or, you know, lay around looking for stuff. They push dirt out and they go back down. So you kind of have to have your timing down too if you're going to take out a gopher. But the method I use that we, you know, when we first heard of it, we thought that this was probably BS, you know, like there's no possible way this could work. But it actually works really good, and I'll explain why a little bit. But so this device you can buy at some hardware stores, or I should say maybe farm stores. Farm stores, I'm pretty sure you'll find this thing, because they have all kinds of nuisance animal control gadgets and predator control stuff too. But anyway, this is a rubber adapter that'll fit over an exhaust pipe, and it has like a hose clamp so you can tighten it down, and then it reduces down to the size of a garden hose, and you just connect your garden hose to it, and then you put your garden hose down in the gopher hole and you know, put some dirt around it, and then you just fire up your engine, let it run for 20 minutes, and what happens is the exhaust gas just fills the tunnels, and it, apparently it's like heavier than air, so it'll kind of just settle down and travel through the tunnel complex and kind of just find its way through the tunnel complex and get to all these deep spaces. And the way, of course, that that works is, you know, the animals just kind of get sleepy and never wake up, which is really good. know, kind of the all bleeding eventually stops thing, but with breathing. So anyway, first thing this morning, my wife saw a new mound, and she was like, well, she had the 22 for a few minutes, maybe 15, 20 minutes while she's waiting to, you know, for the gopher to come up. Because she saw the dirt flying. That's what alerted her, you know, that there was a gopher nearby. So, and the mound just, you know, drove her crazy because she saw the new mound while we're sitting in the hot tub. So, you know, after she waited long enough that she was tired of waiting with the 22, she was like, yeah, we're going to have to gas the gopher. So off I go to get the farm truck. So I have a 79 Chevy pickup. It's kind of my project truck, but right now I haven't done anything on it. I swear this year I'm actually going to get all the bed parts and put it back together and sand it and paint it. Because mechanically, like, it's got a new, brand new crate engine in it. Headers, pipes, transmission, you know, everything on it is really sound. This is really stupid. This is like one of those stupid things that I've done. I took the seat, which was, you know, the seat from the truck, 79 Chevy pickup, and it was beat to crap. And I took it to a guy who does, you know, customizing, and I had the seat, reupholstered and recushioned. He actually redid the entire seat. It's gorgeous. It's green and gold, you know, Packers colors or University of Oregon Duck colors, because they both share the same color scheme. And of course, I went to University of Oregon and I love the Packers. So the seat's all done and it's beautiful, but it's not out there in the truck because the truck's in the implement building. And it's, you know, I mean, it's in the shape you would expect of a 79 Chevy pickup that's in the, you know, that's a farm truck. I mean, it looks like a farm truck, but it won't forever. But anyway, so I went down, got the farm truck and brought it up, and we ran the hoses to it, and there we were gassing gophers for 20 minutes. It takes like 15, they say to run for 15 minutes. I usually run for 20 minutes just to make sure. And you know, so far, we have never had a failure yet. Like, never. And it is the surest way I know to get rid of gophers. Now, I've seen lots of other ways to get rid of gophers, and somebody said a shovel and a garden hose. I tried that a few times, and I'm telling you, I must have some of the largest, or at least I did have some of the largest gopher complexes known to man, because I could run water forever and never fill the dang tunnel system up. And we have really clay soil up here, so it's not like that water is seeping into the ground, because that's one of the difficulties we deal with all the time, trying to raise some food and stuff. But anyway, it seems like it works. So yeah, no kidding. It could have gone Bill Murray. Hey, we kind of joke about that all the time. It's kind of like that movie is such a classic. my wife's always kind of doing the gopher dance too. We're always making fun of the gopher and Caddyshack, the movie with Bill Murray. Oh my God, it's such a classic and hilarious. All right, so I think that's all the stuff I wanted to talk about on the homestead this week. And then I wanted to tell you guys this really kind of crazy story that happened to me. This is going to go in the dental moment of the week segment. Oh, by the way, next week I'm actually going to start a segment, a weekly segment on prepping for, or maybe we'll call it prepping for survival or prepping for a crisis. I mean, you guys probably most, well, I'd say a lot of the people that listen to the shows on Real Liberty Media probably already have a pretty good handle on this, but I'm just going to cover some real basic things And it's not going to be a whole hour-long show unless the subject requires it. But it's just going to be some really simple things that we can do and think about. You know, always good to have a plan. And sometimes, no matter how much we have thought about things, we could have missed something along the way. So I'm just going to use real simple checklists and keep it simple. And if we need to go into more detail on something, we will. But if we don't, we'll just keep it simple. I think that's the best way to do it. I try and, you know, we try and keep things pretty simple and never have to really prepare because we're always prepared. Do you know what I mean? It's like if you always have a plan, if you're always ready for anything, you don't really have to prepare for a crisis or, you know, a pandemic or, you know, whatever. Because you kind of live your life in a preparedness sort of way. And I think that we do a pretty good job at that. Sometimes, you know, there's been some years where we didn't really do much of a garden because, you know, you're thinking everything was going to be okay. But, we're kind of back in the mode of thinking everything's not going to be okay, so we got to make sure to do what we can to always be ready and have, you know, whatever, supplies, food, alcohol, whatever we need to survive. So I'm going to share some of that, and hopefully it'll help people out along the way too. Okay, so here's the crazy story of the week. This is the dental story of the week. Now, I don't know if it's because of age or, you know, if maybe I'm just not one of those people who dreams, or maybe I dream and I just don't remember my dreams. I know that in the past, I remember having dreams, like, regularly, and now it's just like, I don't know, I don't really have dreams anymore, or I just don't recall dreams if I have them. But on Tuesday night, I had a dream that I remembered, and it sucked. It was not a good dream. It didn't cause me any kind of panic, or it wasn't, I guess some people might consider it a nightmare, but I think if you're in a medical profession of any kind, these kind of dreams or these kind of situations, you're always prepared for, so it's never really terrifying. But I'm going to tell you the dream, and then I'm going to tell you what actually happened on Wednesday. So Tuesday night, I kind of woke up, although I didn't really wake up. I just remember thinking, oh, that dream sucked. And this is the dream. I was in my dental clinic. I was providing dental care to an older man who was wearing tan camouflage, you know, khakis, tan camouflage, like a shirt and tan pants. And he didn't have his right leg below the knee. Why is that important? I have no idea. I just remember this dream that vividly. But anyway, I was providing care to him, and he died. Like, died right there in the dental chair. And I just remember thinking, okay, we got to get the AED, we got to get oxygen going, you know, and we kind of start all that stuff and started 911. But he was dead. He was just like dead. No, you know, no pulse, no breathing, no nothing, dead. And when the paramedics got there, you know, so they started taking over. I go, he died. He's dead. And, you know, they started working on him, and that's when my dream ended. Okay, so I'm going to kind of set this up a tiny bit. So let's say my office is a longer building, so a rectangle, and you come in the front and there's a reception desk, and when you come to the back, there's five rooms that are used for treating patients, and they're all in a row. So they're all on the right hand side. You just walk down the hall, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, this guy was in chair 4. Now, this is the real story that happened on Wednesday. And then my office is kind of across the hall from chair 4, behind, basically, there's two doors to get in my office, but my office door is always open and the other door is always closed because of OSHA requirements and keeping things separate, like the break room separate from the clinical area. So there's a couple ways that people tell me a patient is ready. Sometimes they come and tell me a patient is ready, and sometimes I'm just looking at the schedule in my office on the computer, and the color that is associated with the patient on the schedule changes from whatever color it is to a dark blue, and that tells me that the patient is seated and ready to go. So I see that the patient is seated and ready to go, and I come out of my office, and I have to take a little tiny bit of a right angle and then left into that room four. And as I start that left-hand turn into room four, I see an old guy in tan camos with oxygen on, his own oxygen on, and a container to collect urine that he had with him. And he's like slumped over in the chair. I'm only laughing because it's so bizarre how this happens. Number one, I'm thinking to myself, how in the heck did this guy get in my chair? Number one, like, how did he get past the front desk and be seated by the assistant? And I have to admit, I mean, when a patient shows up, we're really going to try and provide care. I mean, that's the goal everybody's hoping that we achieve, is that they show up for the appointment, and then when they get in the chair, we're going to do something for them, hopefully not kill them. So I didn't even walk in the room. I just looked at this guy, and I looked at my assistant. I just shook my head no. Like, no, we are not seeing this guy. Yeah, I mean, this something. Now, maybe it was my dream that kind of set me off, kind of got me thinking, being way more cautious than I normally would have been. Maybe it was the guy's posture, the way he was sitting and his oxygen on and, you know, the urine collection thing. But, yeah, all bleeding eventually stops. No kidding. So I did go in the room and I addressed the patient and I said his name. How are you feeling? And he said, horrible. I said, okay. I said, we are not going to treat you today. I said, when did you start feeling horrible? And he said, well, I mean, part of the story with this guy is he has a lot of stuff going on that he has good reason to feel horrible about. But since he got in the car to come to the clinic that day, he started feeling horrible, like much worse than normal. So he was brought by a caregiver, and she had already left. So I had the front desk call him and started monitoring some vitals, you know, make sure he was breathing. I actually have two of these smart watches. One of them actually does blood pressure, beats per minute, and oxygen saturation. So I just took my watch off and put it on him so I could see how his oxygen was doing and kind of keep track of his blood pressure like every few minutes, because I knew he was either going to the hospital with his caregiver or I was going to call an ambulance. Well, anyway, his caregiver shows up and I kind of ask her the same thing about his condition, and she actually told me, well, as soon as he got in the car, he started complaining that he felt horrible. And I mean, that was his words, horrible. So I said, okay. Oh, and the other thing was his blood pressure was like 178 over 144. So all of you who do blood pressures know, like 144, unacceptable. And we took it a couple times, and sometimes it would be lower, but not acceptable. And mostly it was skyrocket high. So the caregiver showed up, and I told her, I said, look, you know, after I kind of got her a little history from her, and it kind of jived with what he said, I said, okay, you need to take him to the hospital. He needs to go to the hospital. And she kind of looked at me, and I said, do you want me to call an ambulance? And she said, yeah, I want you to call an ambulance. So, of course, called the ambulance. And, of course, you know, you can't just go on caring with about your other patients, which I had two other patients seated, and one the hygienist was seeing, so three other people waiting to see me. But, you know, you can't just go, okay, well, I'll check back with you in a few minutes, because, you know, number one, I had that dream, and number two, the guy looked like he was probably going to die. And I mean, that part will shake you up. I don't care who you are. Well, maybe probably emergency room docs are probably pretty used to that kind of thing. But anyway, the paramedic showed up. They kind of do a whole evaluation, and they determined that he had had a stroke. So of course, off he goes to the hospital, and I did not hear kind of a progress report on him this week, and I didn't hear that he died. So I don't know what the status on him is currently. But that was a crazy freaking day. And I'll tell you a kind of a side story to this whole thing. I had a new assistant start on Tuesday. And so Tuesday she did a lot of orientation stuff. And then Wednesday, my regular assistant had a doctor's appointment. So this poor assistant, who's also a pretty young assistant, only been assisting a couple of years, I think maybe 2 to 4 years, something like that. Here she is in a new clinic, and we have this, you know, medical emergency, pretty serious one too. So it was interesting to say the least, but, yeah, that was pretty crazy. So I guess I guess from now on, I know if I have a dream, I better pay attention to it, no matter what it is. No, I don't know if I'll do that or not. But it was sure kind of after the fact. I actually was close to the point when I went in the clinic that morning of telling my staff that I had this dream and, you know, maybe we should pay attention to stuff. But, I mean, that guy was either the second or third patient, and I hadn't taken the time to say anything. But, man, after it happened, I was sure freaking out about that dream. So that was kind of crazy. Let's see. I've been meaning to talk about this for a while, too. Not that dream. I mean, I'm moving on to something else now. This is interesting, and I don't know if this is the same all across the country. I may have even brought this up before, but I wanted to kind of talk about the practice that I'm in. I literally see dental infections weekly, and I would venture to say almost daily I see dental infections. I would say that it's a higher number now because, like, not because of, but since COVID has come along. But really, I'm not 100% sure of that, because it seems like this practice, this clinic, and this setting just has a lot of people that have dental infections. So it's kind of crazy too. Like, I know I hear this regularly, but it was kind of interesting this week. Again, this kind of younger woman you know, was talking about one of her teeth that I had seen her for, no, I had done an exam on her in the last 2 years, and I told her that this tooth needed to be fixed, at least one of her teeth needed to be fixed, and that, you know, if we fixed it, we probably wouldn't have to do a root canal on it. It was still, you know, kind of fixable. Well, then here she turns up, you know, hadn't come back for any appointments, you know, had been contacted for appointments and just, you know, I don't know, didn't want to come in or whatever. And so she comes in and we're kind of talking about where she's at now. I mean, it was kind of like had to do a new exam and go over how things had changed and all that stuff. And she said, well, she said, you know, that tooth wasn't hurting me yet. And I'm always so surprised. I kind of understand, like, not going to the dentist because it's going to cost you money. But I don't understand waiting until something hurts. Because generally, if something hurts, you're kind of on the edge of it being too late. It kind of depends on what kind of hurt it is. But generally speaking, if your tooth hurts, let's just say, keeping it simple, you have nerves in your teeth and you have blood supply in your teeth. And kind of one of the purposes of that nerve and blood supply, well, one is to kind of protect your teeth, you know, tell you if you bit into a rock or ate something too cold or too hot, your tooth will tell you, hey, that's too hot or too cold, or too hot after eating something too cold. I mean, like, one of my favorite things to do is have pie and ice cream with coffee, and that ice cream is, well, freezing cold, and coffee is like, you know, 150 degrees warmer, and it's not really good to put your teeth through that kind of a temperature change. But I mean, your teeth are pretty resilient, they can take it quite a bit, but it's really not the best thing to do. But anyway, so there's a reason you have this, you know, nerve and blood vessels in your teeth, is to give you some feedback about the environment going on in your mouth, whether it's hot, cold, you know, pressure sensitive, or decay that's entering your tooth and getting to the point where it's going to cause you to need a root canal. So it's kind of interesting to me that people say and somehow believe that, you know, they have to wait till their tooth hurts before they come to the dentist. And I understand the financial thing. Trust me, I grew up poor. I went through, you know, all of that stuff of not having money. And, you know, and kind of I want to say about kind of dental care in general, I really am not a big believer in dental education, and I'll tell you why. Because I'll give you a good example. When I was a dentist on the reservation in southeast Montana, the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation in Lame Deer, Montana, you know, they'd had a program for 20 or 30 years before I ever became a dentist, teaching people about baby bottle tooth decay. I mean, they literally had programs for Head Start, for kindergarten, for grade school, for parents, prenatal, post-delivery parents, about baby bottle tooth decay. And it didn't work. It was still like a rampant cause of decay on the reservation. It just didn't work. And I mean, I don't know how long we've been talking about, you know, brushing your teeth and flossing, and, you know, you can have all this public education money, I guess, and provide all these public service announcements. But I'm telling you, the strongest influence is from the parents, because children, they can go to school and hear that stuff, but what does mom and dad say and what does mom and dad do? That's the greatest determining factor as to how that kid's teeth are going to be, except for the extremely rare disease, and I mean it is extremely rare, that you actually have thin enamel. And there's only a few diseases that actually cause the enamel surface to be thin. And so outside of that, it's basically the parents' influence that really creates this the oral health of the child. And man, I really didn't want to spend this entire hour doing this, but God, time flies. But anyway, I'll finish this thought, or I won't, because maybe I forgot it. oh yeah, I was going to say that people, everybody, like everybody, come, okay, 80% of patients will tell me, yeah, my parents had crappy teeth, so I have crappy teeth. And I'll be honest with you, probably every single dentist in the world wants to say this, but they won't. They want to say, your parents probably didn't have crappy teeth. They had crappy home care, just like you have, because that's where you learned it. But they won't say it, and I don't say it very often, but I will say it in a much different way. And this is the way I'll say it. And I try and explain it, especially to young parents. So like if I have a 20-something-year-old woman come into my clinic and she's had her first baby and, you know, she's asking, or better yet, she brings the baby in for a wellness check, you know, because the baby has some couple teeth and, you know, she's trying to get familiar with what kind of care that's going to look like and, you know, or how often she needs to bring her baby in and all that stuff. And then is a good time to kind of pass on this information. And here's the information. The bacteria that you get in your mouth, a ton of it, I would say virtually all of it, comes from your parents, which kind of can set you up for kind of some dental disease. And without getting scientific, I mean, I am a redneck dentist, so I'm not going to really do that too much. I'll just say this. When you're young, when you're a baby and your parents are feeding you and they take some food, you know, off of a spoon, they eat it and then they use that spoon to feed you or they kiss you, you know, there's a transfer of bacteria. It's impossible for there not to be a transfer of bacteria. And those bacteria can be either, you know, strong cavity bacteria. In other words, they have the propensity to create cavities, or they can be a periodontal kind of bacteria that creates, you know, some periodontal disease, gum disease, bone loss, or you could have both, or you could have like not very strong bacteria. Like I've got to say, I probably didn't have the bacteria that causes a lot of decay or causes periodontal disease because I didn't have a lot of cavities and I wasn't a great, you know, brusher and flosser when I was young and a teenager. And even as a young man, I probably didn't have the greatest oral hygiene. I probably went 24 hours without brushing my teeth, maybe more than once. And fortunately just didn't end up having a lot of decay. Now, I've literally seen families that, you know, have two kids come in and one of them has a ton of cavities and one of them doesn't. And the one that doesn't is one who doesn't brush. And the one who has cavities is one who brushes all the time. And I'm just like, I don't know how that happens, but it happens. Anyway, but I just can tell you, you know, I mean, they teach us that in dental school too. So parenting, I think, is a huge factor, and getting bacteria from your parents is a huge factor. So let's just take a quick example. If you got really strong bacteria that cause a lot of dental disease, and you got really kind of crappy oral hygiene practices because your parents were thinking they're going to lose all their teeth when they're 30, so there's no emphasis put on you keeping your teeth. Guess what? You're going to have like really bad teeth and probably really bad dental experiences and maybe a lot of decay and who knows what else. But you could get that same bacteria from those same parents and have really awesome oral hygiene and not have a ton of decay or periodontal disease. So anyway, I really didn't mean to go so far off on that, but you know what? That's what I do because I'm a dentist and you get me going on that stuff. Okay, I got me going on that stuff and it was an opportunity. What's more important that I really wanted to talk about today, and I can't tell you this is going to be 100% truly the last time I talk about COVID, but I am going to talk about it one more time because I've been thinking about this whole situation, and I wanted to do a little bit of math myself and kind of see exactly how the government kind of screwed this all up. So we're going to shift gears quickly. And I actually was going to talk about this for who knows how long, 30 or 40 minutes, but we could wrap it up pretty quickly, let's hope. So this is an opinion piece, let's say. So I'd say it's my opinion it would have been much easier and quicker to get to herd immunity if we had gone about it a completely different way. And I've been saying this almost from the very beginning, like after the 2 or 3 week thing to kind of see what was going on with COVID, I was hoping that truly we would apply science to that 3 week period of time and come up with a reasonable, rational solution. And I'd been saying almost from the beginning, I mean, in the beginning, they even said the most vulnerable people were people who were 70 years of age or older, or 75 years of age and older, and people with comorbidities, people who had other things that could subject them to having much more serious reactions to the COVID virus. Well, so I was thinking to myself, okay, why don't we just look at real numbers and see what we could have done and what maybe we should have done to not be where we are as far as all of the effects that having people not working for 15 months, to see what kind of effects we could have avoided. So the first thing I did is I started looking at people who were over 70 years old. I wanted to see what percentage of the population in the United States was over 70. And then I actually thought, well, actually, let's go over 75. Because 70 is kind of questionable. You know, if you're in pretty good health, you're going to make it. And I just wanted to see the numbers. So let's look at these two numbers. 15% of the United States population is over 70 years old, and 12% is over 75 years old. So let's say, and I didn't, for this purpose, to look at these numbers, I didn't look at the mortality rate of people between the ages of, let's say just below 70 or below 75. I kind of ignored the numbers of deaths below age 70 and 75 because they're significantly lower than people over 70 or 75. But even, let's just look at this. What if you took a number, say age 65. What if you said people age 65 and older, those people need to take, and I'm not going to say the government should have put any restrictions in place. I'm going to say those people should have been able to to put whatever precautions and safety measures in place they needed to do to keep themselves safe. Because 65 is kind of the retirement age of the United States, or maybe 70, I guess now people work longer, you know, or choose to work longer or not, but it just, that just seems like that would be a reasonable age to maybe subtract from the equation. But let's say if you just took the 70, if you just took people over 70, so 15% of people are over 70. If we would have just said to the rest of the population, look, if you're under 70, continue with your life. Don't stop working. Don't stop playing. Don't stop going out and eating. Don't social distance. Don't wear masks. Let's get this thing done. And, you know, we're going to be sick. Everybody's probably going to get sick. The goal is, in herd immunity, the goal is to get a certain percentage of the population infected. Now, do you think you can get a certain percentage of the population infected by keeping them isolated, by keeping them indoors, by keeping having people wear masks and social distance? That's exactly the opposite set of things that you needed to do to reach herd immunity. I don't have good things to say about the people who are put in those government positions. Those government positions, I'll tell you, I've said it before, they are great jobs with great benefits. But we don't always get, in fact, I can guarantee you, we never get the brightest minds in those positions. Never. And I've said before, the brightest minds go elsewhere and do their work and become, you know, famous for, well, at least famous in their perspective areas of expertise, because they write papers and they, you know, discover things and, you know, they get famous in their little arena for that. Government employees, they get famous because somebody points to them and says, guess what, you're the spokesperson for COVID. Now go take care of it. So anyway, so we could have had, if we would have had everybody 75 years and older, and the much smaller, minute population of people that could be considered as having comorbidities. And basically, in my notes, the show notes, you'll see if you go to Real Liberty Media and look at the podcast, look at the blog post, there's going to be a posting of a table that actually shows you what is considered a comorbidity. And, you know, I've had patients come in, you know, patients will tell you anything. Like they have what's that disease called? Fibromyalgia. You know, they have fibromyalgia, their joints hurt, and they tell me, you know, that they're in danger of dying of COVID. Not so much, at least not on this list. Most of the things were like morbid obesity, any kind of chest or heart function that was already, you know, kind of compromised. You know, breathing, important, and when you get a flu or, you know, a virus that has respiratory effects, yeah, that's not good. So, you know, you'd want to avoid being in the group of people who's going out and becoming infected. But so 85% of the population could have continued their lives as normal, and we would already be, in my opinion, we would have reached herd immunity months ago. Yeah, people would die. People are going to die anyway. I mean, we're not preventing deaths necessarily by social distancing and wearing masks and staying isolated at home. Eventually, we have to reach this herd immunity. I mean, that's the way diseases are controlled. It's not something we can do. It's not something we do consciously. It's what diseases do. You know, they got to run their course, whatever course that is. So all we have done is interfered in this virus's ability to run its course. And it's going to come. You're going to see it. Let's just say the jab that they're giving us, given people, is not going to do the job. I mean, if they're terrified of variants, going back to this argument, the best way to get through it is to let this thing run rampant for a bit until we have this herd immunity. And I actually did the numbers. If I added up, all of the people that have been infected with COVID, that's 32.6 million. That was on the day that I looked at the, numbers. That's 10% of the population. And the number of people that have got the jab so far is 56 million, which is 16%. So at the very best right now, after 15 months of hemming and hawing about whether 6 feet was the correct distance, or 3 feet, or 12 feet, or 15, or 20 feet. Or do you remember when they were talking about, well, if somebody is in an aisle over from you in the supermarket, you could get it? I mean, I remember all of these stupid things, all these retarded frickin' jokes that we've kind of lived in the past 15 months. None of that, all of that stuff just interfered with us reaching herd immunity. And we are still going to see probably the same percentages of deaths that we would have seen, or that we have been seeing. We'll probably see the same percentage of people die if we just, open up the faucet right now and say, everybody, just go do your thing. There's going to be a lot of illness going around. Get used to it. If you think you have to go to the hospital, go. Otherwise, just ride it out. Anyway, that's what I got for today. Thanks, you guys in chat. You've been very busy. I appreciate it. I couldn't stop and read and talk, because if I did, I would have been here another hour. I'll look forward to seeing you guys next week. Thanks.